You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. As you've been hearing, overnight, Russian military forces and Russian-backed separatists invaded Ukraine using planes, missiles, helicopters, and troops. Russian President Vladimir Putin authorized the military action, which is coming from Ukraine's eastern, northern, and southern borders. So we want to dive a bit more into this. So joining us live now are Florian Justwan, an associate professor of political science at the University of Idaho, and Aaron Kimball-Dumman is a clinical assistant professor for the International Studies Program at the University of Idaho. Tonight, they will join other U of I faculty members for a virtual panel discussion about the causes and the consequences of the war in Ukraine. Before then, they have been nice enough to join us here live on Idaho Matters. I want to thank both of you for coming on the program.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
We're very happy to be here.
So, Florian, I'd like to start the conversation with you, and let's talk a little bit about history, because I think, you know, that's a good place to start for folks who maybe have not paid a lot of attention to that part of the world over the years. We have been watching Russian troops moving to the border to Ukraine for weeks now. However, you say that this crisis actually started all the way back in 2014.
That's right, yeah. So I think one thing that's very important to understand is that Ukraine is a deeply divided country. There is an eastern part of the country that is primarily pro-Russia, it's Russian-speaking. There's a western part of the country that's Ukrainian-speaking, and that tends to be a little bit more pro-European, pro-West in its political orientation. Now in 2014, these dynamics led to a major crisis between Ukraine and Russia. There was a pro-Russian government in power in Ukraine, and that pro-Russian government got toppled in a public revolution. And then as a result, Russia used its military to invade and annex the Crimean Peninsula. But Russia also helped to initiate and sustain separatist movements in eastern Ukraine, and it encouraged these regions to break away from the country. So that's the larger context for this military conflict that we're witnessing today.
And then, Aaron, you have said that the expansion of NATO is a security dilemma for Russia. Can you explain that? And what does Russia have to fear in regards to that?
Well, that's a good question, because from those of us in the West, we don't see ourselves as very threatening. We tend to perceive Russia as the threatening party, and that NATO was designed purely as a self-defense mechanism against an aggressive Russia or an aggressive Soviet Union back in the day. From the Russian perspective, however, it is very much an alliance, a military alliance built up against them. When it was first established in 1949, it was made up of 12 countries who were very far towards the west of Europe and the United States and Canada. Over time, NATO has expanded east, most recently into area that Russia considers to be very much part of its neighborhood. Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Romania, these countries that fell very much within the sphere of Russian influence for a long time. And Russia does not appreciate that. No superpower appreciates having what they perceive of as adversaries building military alliances right along their borders. This has been a sore point for Putin for decades, honestly. And he started to push this issue with the United States and with NATO. He's brought it up several times, but most recently back in December, he made demands that we agree never to let Ukraine join NATO. And that is something that NATO members were not willing to agree to. So from the Russian perspective, it was it may not have been perceived as a threat, but it could be talked about as a threat. And if you listen to Putin speak last night, much of what he gave as his rationale for walking into Ukraine was that it was potentially going to be expanded into NATO.
And with that said, though, Aaron, at the same time, the president of Ukraine also spoke last night, first saying that he tried to reach out to Putin. He says Putin, you know, did not pick up the phone. But he also then spoke to the Russian people. and saying that I know you won't hear this, but we are not all of these things that Putin is saying we are. So there seems to be this idea that even goes maybe beyond NATO of the westernization of of other parts of the world.
I think that's absolutely true. Florian, you're the more expert on the westernization idea, if you'd like to.
Russia or NATO represents lots of different things. On the one hand, mm-hmm. it represents a military alliance that has huge implications on the security front. But if we look at Putin's rhetoric over the course of the last few years, honestly, you'll see that for him, NATO represents a much larger threat, the threat of westernization in Russia's own backyard. So if Ukraine were to join NATO at some point in the future, in Putin's mind, this would not only be a security threat, but it would further drive forward a westernization and it would further move Ukraine as a country into the Western European fray and away from the Russian sphere of influence. That has happened in the past, right? There are other countries that have undergone what Russia considers to be a westernization process. So the country of Georgia would be an example here. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the Baltic countries would be an example here. But given the kind of historic importance of Ukraine for Russia, this is something that Putin is really pushing back on very hard.
If you're just joining us, let me reintroduce our guest for you, because we are speaking about Russia's invasion of Ukraine with Florian Jaswan, an associate professor of political science, and Aaron Kimball Duman, a clinical assistant professor for the International Studies program. They both are with the University of Idaho, and they will be a part of a panel discussion of faculty members, a virtual panel discussion this evening about the causes and consequences of the war in Ukraine. So with that being said, Florian, you said that Ukraine is culturally and politically divided as a country, because you have a Russian-speaking eastern part of the country, and then you have a Ukrainian-speaking western part of the country. But I would assume that, you know, there has to be more than just a language divide if we're talking about politics and culture. So can you tell us a little bit more about that country, because they used to be a part of Russia.
So yeah, so you're right. So the language divide is only one of the most visible manifestations of that cultural divide in Ukraine. I think that divide also becomes very very clear when you look at voting data from Ukraine. So during any given presidential election, you have major parties campaigning for presidency and parliament, of course. And these parties generally advocate for either closer relations with Russia or closer relations with the West, with NATO and with the European Union. Now, if you look at where these different parties get most of their support from, you'll see that the pro-Russian parties generally do much better in the eastern Russian-speaking part of the country, and the pro-European parties, if you want to put it that way, are generally much stronger politically in the western part of the country. So I think it's right that the language division is only a very superficial way to talk about these divisions, but those cultural divisions and political divisions in the country are real and they're meaningful.
Well, and Florian, I think this is so interesting, because I think we can look at the United States and where we are climate and culture wise right now, and there are great divides within our own country, within our own culture politically. You know, you take the coasts, right? And they seem to be more liberal leaning. And then you've got the remainder of the country, which is more conservative. We had an attack on our U.S. Capitol. It doesn't seem in some ways that this political divide, we're not just seeing it in one part of the world.
Yeah, no, that's right. No, so It's right. So the United States is a polarized country in the way, and Ukraine is a politically polarized country. I think what's important to understand is that the question of where Ukraine's place in the world is, mm-hmm. is one of the most salient and probably important questions to Ukrainian voters. So this is not just a question about a minor policy issue here, but whether or not Ukraine should seek closer relations with the European Union and NATO or with Russia, mm-hmm. as an alternative, is that's the question that keeps people up at night. That's the question that political campaigns are being fought over. So it's one of the primary political issues, and it has been in Ukraine over the course of the last few decades.
And with that said, Aaron, can we talk about the legalities of this? I would think that when you invade a country, that is not legal, in particular, according to NATO. What Putin is doing, is it considered legal? I mean, how does that fit into international law?
So the principle of territorial integrity is one that has been codified as customary international law for hundreds of years, honestly. Political scientists like to go back and talk about the Treaty of Westphalia back in 1648. But most recently, it has been enshrined in the UN Charter, in Article 2.4 of the UN Charter. It is one of the primary reasons why the UN was created in the first place, was to protect this international system of stability and sovereign integrity of the member states. So the only way that you are supposed to start a war or take part in conflict, mm-hmm. is out of some kind of need of self-defense. So Putin has had to work himself into rhetorical knots a bit to try and call what he is doing justifiable under international law. And it appears that he's trying to do this in a bunch of different ways. So first, when he talks about NATO as being threatening, right, it becomes this rhetoric that allows for him to speak of the invasion of Ukraine as a move of self-defense. Right? He talks about this as a life or death issue for the Russian state. We know that there is no actual threat from Ukraine at the moment, or from NATO at the moment, towards Russia. But they couch it in that language so that they can bring forward this other part of the UN Charter that allows them to break this really strong norm on territorial integrity. Similarly, when he brings up language about a potential genocide against the Russian speakers within Ukraine, or the Ukraine potentially becoming a threat to Russia, he is making reference to a more recent part of international law known as the responsibility to protect, which came out, was codified or formalized in 2005 in the face of a lot of very terrible humanitarian disasters that had happened around the world. And the idea being that states may intervene in the affairs or the domestic affairs of other countries under certain conditions. Most specifically, if a genocide is going on or some other kind of crimes against humanity are happening. So when he brings forward this idea about there being a genocide, what he's saying is, we're not invading. It's a humanitarian intervention that we must do in order to protect the Russian speakers in Ukraine. Again, it's nothing about this is factually accurate. It's part of a major mm-hmm. disinformation campaign on the part of the Russian state. But it allows him to build a framework around what he's doing that would be, if it was factual, in agreement with international norms and law.
So at this point, we know that Putin has said that the Ukraine is full of Nazis, that the country is committing genocide, that Ukraine is planning to build a nuclear weapon. None of this is true, as far as we know. I know you're both worried about a Russian misinformation campaign happening now, but in the coming weeks. Florian, can we start with you? And first off, let's talk about this misinformation campaign and the potential long-term effects of what Putin is saying.
Yeah, so it's really interesting because what Russia has been doing over the course of the last few weeks is aggressively spreading these false claims in order to muddy the waters about what is currently happening. So Putin doesn't want the world to know what is really happening on the ground, and he wants there to be ambiguity about how this crisis started, who did what at the beginning of the crisis, and how it all played out. And what's interesting is this information campaign seems to be targeted at two different types of audiences. On the one hand, he seems to be targeting voters in Russia to get them on board with this military mission. But he also seems to be targeting voters in countries around the world, in Latin America in particular, in order to make it harder for the governments the governments in these countries to take decisive action against Russia. So we know from political science that in order to take costly steps against the country, there needs to be public support for something like this. And if Russia were to successfully muddy the waters there and get the public to doubt the necessity to respond decisively to Putin's invasion, then this would make it politically quite costly for countries around the world to really stand up to him.
And Aaron, can you talk about what a misinformation campaign would look like in the coming weeks? I mean, how would that look to the rest of the world?
My guess is that it would look like news reports about things that aren't necessarily happening on the ground, about genocidal acts. What else might it be? Social media posts. Mm-hmm.
How would it also, I guess, play out in the sense of what it would look like in Russia? And we touched on this a little bit earlier, but yeah. I mean, there is state-run media, there is state-run television in Russia. So you can definitely create a narrative around what you want your citizens to know. So could that misinformation campaign be successful if there was no other way to get information if you are inside Russia?
So I think it will be relatively successful to an extent. Certainly Putin has made a big showing internally, lots of pomp and circumstance, televised calling of all of his ministers forward to say, do you agree with me on this war? And what is your justification for this war? And the kinds of speeches that he's giving that are very much speaking directly to his own people, but also to the near abroad and to American people. So he's making a very, very strong push to put his own face and his own message out there on these things. Obviously, he also controls, or the Russian state, I should say, controls most of the media outlets. I believe that there are some ways that Russians are able to get information out of the West, but it is probably, they're probably doing their best to counteract those kinds of messages. So the Russian people, we know that there are protests going on. There are anti-war protests happening in Russia as we speak. Those protesters are being arrested. It appears that the Russian state is also clamping down on any sort of dissent around this issue very fast and very hard. So there's the dual elements there, right? They're trying to win people over with the disinformation campaign, but at home, they're quite capable of just using the repressive capacity of the state against their own people.
Both of you have been watching the buildup of these Russian troops. But when the attack finally happened overnight, and we see it in real time happening, were either of you surprised that it actually reached this level? Florian, I'll start with you.
No, I wasn't surprised at all. And I think part of the reason why I wasn't surprised is that there is a lot of research in the field of political science that studies crisis escalation. Mm-hmm. And there's this one really, this one literature that makes it really clear that whenever political leaders escalate a crisis to the point that Putin escalated it to, backing down in that crisis is really difficult unless a leader is okay with losing face in the international community, but also with its own citizens. So this did not come as a surprise to me personally.
No,
and
I second
your thoughts on that.
No, I think most of us in the political science community have just been waiting. It's been expected. You know, we were thinking our panel that's happening tonight might even be a little bit outdated because we thought maybe the war would happen last week or start last week. It's Putin has been telegraphing this to the international community overtly and very specifically for weeks.
So Florian, I know that we don't know where this crisis is going to go for sure, but let's talk about some of the possible consequences of this. Things like energy prices, effects on the supply chain. What about refugees? Because people are fleeing, or at least trying to now get out of the country.
Yeah, so a lot of observers of this crisis have been really worried that should a major conflict break out, then now it looked like that happened, there would be significant numbers of refugees trying to leave the country in all directions. So European observers in particular have been trying to prepare themselves for, according to one source, millions of refugees trying to cross the border into the European Union. Should this really happen, this would be a really major challenge, not just for the European Union, but also for other Western countries that would certainly be expected to help out in dealing with this refugee crisis.
Mm-hmm. I think it's really important that we do not underestimate what is happening in Ukraine right now. We saw Russian tanks, we saw planes, we saw bombs, missiles, 200,000 troops start moving into Ukraine overnight. We have not seen an invasion like this in Europe since World War II. Aaron, your thoughts on that? Because I think it is sometimes difficult to understand the gravity of this happening anywhere in the world, let alone in Europe, which is a more westernized part of the world.
There are those of us in political science and international studies that are watching this and see it as a potential real challenge to the liberal world order that was established in the post-World War II moment. Certainly there was the Cold War for a great stretch of time in which the Soviet Union challenged that particular setup. But since the end of the Cold War, the United States and the United States' vision of what a world order should be has really dominated. And we have recently seen that both Russia and China find this very challenging, and they are pushing back against this sort of liberal world order. So if Russia succeeds in taking the Ukraine without facing severe consequences enough to back down away from these moves, it sets a precedent. It is one that China is probably watching very closely and Taiwan watching closer still. And there are other regions in the world that will be thinking that perhaps territorial integrity is beginning to weaken, and that the United States' control on the international world order is also weakening. And I think we may be seeing ourselves entering into a multipolar world with all of the ramifications that come with that.
And if I may add on to this, I think
yes,
it also, one of the other reasons why this might become a really defining moment in global politics in the 21st century is because the United States, over the course of the last few decades, has diverted its attention away from Europe, I believe. So I think it's fair to say that the United States has been more focused perhaps on China
and non-state actors
exactly in its pursuit of foreign policy. But that might change again. So with what we're just witnessing, I think there is an argument to be made within the White House and within the halls of power in the United States that more emphasis should be put on, again, what are the geopolitics of Europe and how should the United States deal with Russia in particular?
And how does then these sanctions fall into that President Biden just put on Russia? Now we do know that he's announced these stepped up sanctions on Russian banks, on elites, but he has not sanctioned Putin at this point.
Yeah, so a lot needs to be. It will be interesting to see how Biden's announcements will then be implemented in actual policy. So the speech that he gave kind of gave us the broad outlines of what the sanctions regime is going to be that the United States and its allies are going to place on Russia. But the actual implementation then needs to be followed through with some kind of written document that spells out all of the details. It remains to be seen how this is really going to look like. But it is true that, from my understanding, there are a few steps that the United States and its allies haven't announced that could theoretically still be taken in the future. So, for instance, sanctioning Putin directly is one possibility. Another step is there are still more drastic steps that could be taken to cut off Russia from global financial transactions. And it's at this point not quite clear to me anyway if this is because the United States wants to keep these options in the back pocket or if there were certain challenges that made it hard to really implement them at this time.
Mm-hmm. I think it's important that currently we're also seeing a united front among NATO, Western Europe, and the United States, but a lot of the rest of the world is still kind of holding off to see how this is going to play out. Very specifically, we don't know where China is going to ultimately decide to fall on this matter. The other thing that I think is important to point out is that we can only go so far so long as we do not want to end up in a military conflict with Russia. Some of the major tools that we have available to us in international law, we cannot bring to bear in this situation. I mean, very recently, the International Criminal Court managed to create within its portfolio what we call the crime of aggression, right? Which is probably, obviously, they haven't been convicted of this yet, but what Russia is currently committing right now. However, the International Criminal Court does not have jurisdiction over Russia or Russian nationals. And the only other way that they could be found brought before that court is via the United Nations Security Council, which everyone will know that Russia is a member of that and therefore can veto any potential bringing of their own actions in Ukraine before the ICC. So some of the major tools that the international community has to try and rein in actors in these ways cannot be brought to bear against Putin.
I know that none of us have a crystal ball, and we do not know how all of this is going to move forward, what is going to happen. With that said, if you did have a crystal ball, do you believe that the world has changed forever based on what happened overnight?
That's a big question.
I know it is.
I think that Europe has changed. Europe is part of the world, so that's probably yes. I think that the security architecture in Europe has changed in the sense that no matter what the outcome of the crisis is, the issue of where is Ukraine's place in Europe will be resolved at the end of the crisis. Mm. Europe has also changed in the sense that it will become much more focused on Russia and the potential threat that Russia poses to specifically Eastern European countries. Whether that has large implications for China's dispute with Taiwan or other territorial disputes in the world, that is probably a too big of a question to ask, but I do know a lot of people who study territorial disputes who were on Twitter today and were really worried about the potential implications of Russia's military aggression.
Yeah. I want to thank both of you for taking time out of your day to talk with us about this and to explain it so that I think that, you know, we all have a better understanding of what is going on and the impact and the importance of how we move forward. We have been talking with Florian Jaswan, an associate professor of political science at the University of Idaho, and Aaron Kimball-Doman, a clinical assistant professor for the International Studies Program. They will both be part of a virtual panel tonight on the causes and the consequences of the war in Ukraine. Anyone can listen in to that talk this evening. I want to thank you both again for your time. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
And I want to thank all of you, our listeners, for being a part of Idaho Matters. Our senior producer is Samantha Wright. Thank you, Samantha, for everything you did today to move things around and get us on the air. I'm Gemma Gaudet. It is a kind of snowy Thursday out there on this end of February. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Thank you.